Okay, so I'm just going to go ahead and lead with this today. I don't want to harp on it. You know, I don't want to be that lady. So just note the gentle reminder as we get into today's material. Noted? Duly noted. Okay, one of the things I want to constantly remind you of as we work our way through this material is that we are not starting anew every week. We are studying this one letter, and it has one overarching purpose. So remember, James is calling us to a wholehearted commitment to Christ. So everything in this letter is pushing us toward that end, right? To a consistent and to an uncompromising Christian lifestyle. So as part of that, James is asking us to examine the strength and the stability of our faith. So really what we have here in the first half of chapter 1 is James putting before us these things that he thinks might cause our faith to waver. And he gives us these two really broad categories. In the first category of things we talked about last week, and this is number 1 on your handout, what were those? Trials. Good. And then the second category of things that James thinks might cause our faith to stumble, we're going to talk about today. And what do you think that is? Temptation. So James puts forth these two things of trials and temptation as potential threats to our faith. And then really, he just goes about schooling us in them, right? Does anybody besides me feel a little bit schooled over these past few weeks? And then what we're going to get in a little later in the letter is James going to point out parts of our lives where he feels like our faith might already be wavering. So he's going to point out inconsistencies in the life that we lead and the faith that we proclaim. And he's going to ask us to look really carefully at those areas of our lives so that we can self-correct where necessary. So that is what is coming down the pipe for us. But tonight, this morning, we want to talk about temptation, okay? So let's look at James chapter 1. We're going to start just one verse back in 12 from last week. James 1, starting in verse 12. Blessed is the man who remains steadfast under trial, for when he has stood the test, he will receive the crown of life, which God has promised to those who love him. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, for God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. So if we follow the flow of James's letter, he goes straight from the topic of trials and into the topic of temptations without any even skipping a beat, right? In the ESV, there's not even a paragraph break there. So what the close proximity of those two ideas tell us is that there is a connection, at least in James's mind, between the idea of a trial and the idea of a temptation. And that is a connection that we do not want to miss. So look at number 2 on your handout, and we're going to get that out of the way first thing. And this is the connection. Every trial, which we can understand as some sort of external difficulty, carries with it a temptation or an inner enticement to sin. So every trial carries with it a temptation. Now, why is it so imperative that we understand that? I want you to open your Bibles to Matthew 26, and that's where your first sticky note needs to go. Matthew 26, and just put a sticky note on that page so you can find it easily throughout today's lesson. So when you get to Matthew 26, you're going to notice that it is a huge chapter. So I want you to just kind of quickly scan the paragraph heading so you can get an idea of where we are in the gospel story. So in Matthew 26, the elders and the chief priests have conspired to kill Jesus. Judas has agreed to betray him. We have Jesus celebrating Passover with his disciples, so that's the scene known as the Last Supper. And then Jesus takes his disciples. Jesus into the Garden of Gethsemane to pray. And so something I want you to know as we're going into this scene at the Garden of Gethsemane is that Jesus is not going into this blind. Okay? He has some idea of everything that is about to fall upon him. So understanding that, I want us to start reading in verse 38. Then he said to them, "My soul is very sorrowful, even to death. Remain here and watch with me." So that word "watch" is significant here, and it's going to occur several more times in this short reading that we're going to go through. It means to stay awake or to keep alert. So I want you to circle it or underline it every time that you see it in these next few verses. So let's keep going. Verse 39. "And going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, 'My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will.' And he came to the disciples and found them sleeping, and he said to Peter, 'So you could not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray that you may not enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak.'" Okay, so I want all of you to look closely at verse 41. I want you to read it silently to yourself one more time. And when you've done that, look up at me. Okay, what did Jesus tell his disciples to watch for?
Temptation.
Temptation. That was a huge revelation to me. Because although I have read this countless times, I realized that I had always underemphasized Jesus' emphasis on the temptation here. I think in my head, I thought, well, if I was Jesus, it makes a lot of sense that he would tell them to watch for what? The crowd, right? The crowd that was coming to kill him. That is not at all what Jesus is doing here, because Jesus had already submitted himself to what was going to happen with the crowd. Okay, we know that because we see him struggling in these verses. See, in verse 39, we see the struggle. He said, "Father, if this cup can pass for me, allow it." But where does he settle on? "But not my will. Your will be done." So Jesus has submitted himself to the trial. So he is not watching and praying against the trial. He is watching and praying so he does not overcome by the temptation that follows the trial. That is what we have happening here, and I want to prove that to you for those of you who you're giving me kind of a stink eye, like you're not too sure about it, okay? So go to Luke chapter 4, so you've marked Matthew 26 because we're coming right back there. Turn to Luke 4, and that's for your second sticky note. Now in Luke 4, we have Luke's account of the temptation of Christ. So for those of you who might be a little newer at Bible study, the temptation of Christ is recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And it's the scene where right before Jesus begins his public ministry, after he is baptized, then he is taken out into the wilderness. And for 40 days and 40 nights, he is tempted by Satan himself. And during this time period, Satan throws everything he can think of at Jesus, but Jesus does not waver. He is wholeheartedly committed to what the Father has sent him to do. So then at the end of that time period, I want you to look at something. Look at verse 13. Luke 4, verse 13. "And when the devil had ended every temptation, he departed from him until an opportune time." Now flip back to Matthew 26. And I want you to tell me, does this not seem like the opportune time? Satan had been waiting and watching as well. So this right here in the Garden of Gethsemane is the lowest point of Jesus' life on this earth. And you can bet that his enemy was there. That is what's happening here. So in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus submits himself to the forthcoming trial, but then he readies himself for the temptation that was going to follow. And I'm going to tell you what I think that temptation is. I think Jesus had to fight the temptation to not stop the whole darn thing right then and there. To not just call forth the army of angels that was just waiting for his word. Because wasn't that the very thing that the tempter had tempted him with back in the wilderness? We're going to look there in a few minutes, but some of you know that scene of the temptation of Christ well enough to know that Satan says to Jesus, "Hey, didn't your father say something about being able to command his armies and guard you?" But Jesus did not fall to that temptation back in the wilderness, and he did not fall for it in the garden. Look at what he says in Matthew 26, verse 53. This is Jesus. He says, "Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father, and he will at once send me more than 12 legions of angels? But how then should scriptures be fulfilled?" So Jesus' spirit was willing to do the work that the Father had put before him. And we know this, but this is something that I think we have to understand. Jesus was wrapped up in flesh and bone. Just like all of us in here, he was not a superhuman in the way that I think we sometimes lay down on him. He was not unable to be hurt by the slings and arrows of life. If he was, then he would not be able to identify us with us in every way, like the book of Hebrews says that he can. So he was willing, but he knew that in his humanity, his flesh was woefully weak. So he set his eyes on watching and on praying so that the temptation would not overcome him. And what's more, Jesus had an idea of what was coming for the disciples in the days, in the hours following his betrayal and his arrest. And so what did he tell them to do? Watch and pray. He told them to do the very thing that he was practicing himself. Watch and pray so that you will not enter into temptation. So let's follow that scene out just a little bit further. We're still in chapter 26. Jesus says it's go time. Judas shows up with this crowd of people carrying swords and clubs. And in a moment, the trial is upon them. Now, Jesus had been watching and praying, so he was ready when the temptation came, right? And he did not fall. But what does his disciples do? What have they been doing? They have been sleeping, not watching, not praying. So what happened? They fell. Look at the last sentence of verse 56. Then all the disciples left him and fled. So Jesus is arrested and he is taken away. And then I want you to scan down and look at verse 69. Now Peter was sitting outside in the courtyard, and a servant girl came up to him and said, "You also were there with Jesus the Galilean." But he denied it before them all, saying, "I do not know what you mean." And when he went out to the entrance, another servant girl saw him, and she said to the bystanders, "This man was with Jesus of Nazareth." And again, he denied it with an oath, "I do not know the man." After a little while, the bystanders came up and said to Peter, "Certainly, you too are one of them, for your accent betrays you." Then he began to invoke a curse on himself and to swear, "I do not know the man." So the trial hit, and the temptation that followed caught Peter so off guard that he never even stood a chance. This was the very same disciple that just hours before had stood before Jesus and said, never deny you. I do not know the man. I do not know the man. I do not know the man. Three times. Double-minded, unstable, driven and tossed by the wind. So ladies, every trial that comes at us is going to be followed with a temptation. So we are ready and we are alert, ready to stand against it. Okay? So let's return to James 1:13. Let no one say when he is tempted, "I am being tempted by God." For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. So James jumps right into this topic of temptation by kind of defensively asserting number three. God cannot be tempted, and he does not tempt. Number three on your handout, God cannot be tempted, and he does not tempt. So I don't know how you guys took it when you were reading it on your own, but the way it kind of came off to me, it was almost like James is just shutting this conversation down, right? Like perhaps it's something that has already been discussed ad nauseum, and he is just ready for these people to get it and to move on. And I think it's quite possible that that is exactly what is happening here, because this is a topic that had been deeply embedded in the story of Israel. So we're going to take a look at how it played itself out in the history of those people so that we can figure out how it might play itself out in our lives as well. So, number four on your handout. One of our greatest temptations in the face of trial is to put God to the test. One of our greatest temptations in the face of trial is to put God to the test. So I want you to turn back over to Luke 4, and we're going to start this discussion by using that same scene of the temptation of Christ. Luke 4, and we're going to start reading in verse 9. And he, this is Satan, and he took him to Jerusalem and set him on the pinnacle of the temple and said to him, "If you are the Son of God, throw yourself down from here, for it's written, he will command his angels concerning you to guard you. And on their hands they will bear you up, lest you strike your foot against a stone." And Jesus answered him, "It is said, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test." Okay, so this verse in Luke 4, where Jesus says, "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test," gives us a really amazing opportunity to use the Bible to study the Bible. Because what we have here is Jesus quoting Scripture. So when he says, "You shall not put the Lord your God to the test," notice that it's in quotation marks. So Jesus is quoting from the Torah, from the book of Deuteronomy. So we're going to use a really neat Bible study technique called cross-referencing to figure out what he means here. And when we cross-reference something, all we do is we look up similar instances where that same word or that phrase occurs elsewhere in the Bible. Not if you understand what I'm saying. Okay, so we're going to cross-reference. So to figure that out, where did Jesus quote this from? I want you to turn to Deuteronomy chapter 6. And put a sticky note there, because I know you're going to go back and read it later. Okay, as you're getting Deuteronomy chapter 6, let me tell you what we're stepping into here, because this is a bit of a tense scene. So Moses is basically standing in front of the Israelites, and he is laying down the law. I mean, he has been wandering around in the wilderness with these people for 40 years. He's trying to prepare them to enter into the promised land, and he really does not want them to mess it up. Okay? So he's laying it out real clear for them. So let's start reading in verse 10. And again, this is Moses speaking. And when the Lord your God brings you into the land that he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob to give you, with great and good cities that you did not build, and houses full of all good things that you did not build, and cisterns that you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees that you did not plant. And when you eat and are full, then take care, lest you forget the Lord who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. It is the Lord your God you shall fear. Him you shall serve, and by his name you shall swear. You shall not go after other gods, the gods of the peoples who are around you, for it is the Lord your God in your midst, and he is a jealous God. Lest the anger of the Lord and your God be kindled against you, and he destroy you from off the face of the earth. You shall not put the Lord your God to the test as you tested him at Massah. Okay, this is getting exciting. Can you feel the excitement? Okay, because what we see is that that verse that Jesus quoted up in Luke 4 took us where? To Deuteronomy chapter 6, but it's actually taking us even further back to something that happened at Massah. So what happened at Massah, right? Because I have the feeling it must have been really bad. Okay, so let's go to what happened at Massah, and to find that out, we're going to have to go to Exodus chapter 14. Chapter 17, actually. Go to Exodus chapter 17. Exodus 17. Yes, sticky noted, sister. Go for it. Okay, as you're turning to Exodus chapter 17, let me tell you where we are. So even those of you who haven't studied the Bible long are probably familiar with what happened starting back in Exodus chapter 14. Because that's the big Charlton Heston moment of scripture, right? When Moses leads the Israelites through the Red Sea and free from Egyptian captivity. So that is how God moved in Exodus chapter 14. In Exodus chapter 15, we see him provide miraculously fresh, clean water for them to drink in the wilderness. In Exodus chapter 16, we see that he rains forth bread from the sky. So that is chapter 14, 15, 16. We arrive here in Exodus chapter 17, and let's begin reading in verse 1. All the congregation of the people of Israel moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Verse 2. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, "Give us water to drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?" But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, "Why did you bring us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" So Moses cried to the Lord, "What shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me." And the Lord said to Moses, "Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink." And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the place Massah, which means testing, and Meribah, which means quarreling, because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they tested the Lord by saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" So a lot happened there. So let's take a look at what went on. Okay, so verse 1, the Israelites are faced with another trial. What's their trial? No water. They're thirsty, right? And don't you suppose that that could be the most natural thing in the world to get a little nervous about? right? Out of all of the things that we think we need, one of the things we actually need is water, and we need it basically every day. So I suppose it could be very natural for the Israelites to get a bit testy at this point, but they had a history with God. God had parted the Red Sea. He had turned the bitter water sweet. He had rained forth bread from the sky. But the first time they run into another trial, they immediately begin asking, "What are your intentions for us? What is your heart toward us?" The trial caused the Israelites to question whether God was even on their side. Look at how verse 7 describes the test. It says, they tested the Lord by saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" So the Israelites looked around at their present circumstances, and despite how faithful God had been in their past, they didn't know if they could trust him with their presence. So they tested him by making him prove his faithfulness again and again and again, which he would have done anyway, but without the test. So you see their double-mindedness and the instability there? So the Jewish Christians who James wrote this letter to would have been very familiar with those stories that we just read. They would have been familiar with the historic propensity of their people to doubt God in the face of trial, to question him, to accuse him of tempting them, of enticing them towards sin. So James shuts down the topic really quickly. God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempts no one. So number 5 on your handout. He may allow the trial, but he does not entice the sin. He may allow the trial, but he does not entice the sin. So I know we're all wondering that if God doesn't do it, then who is to blame? Verse 14. But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desire. So James places the responsibility for temptation and sin squarely on the shoulders of each and every individual believer. And his purpose in doing so is number 6 on your handout. He wants to emphasize every individual's responsibility for her own sin. You know what I wanted James to say here? The devil made you do it. Right? It was his fault. He put it right there in front of you. He tempted you. He lured you. He enticed you. But you notice James doesn't give us any such scapegoat. He says you were lured and enticed all right, but by your own evil desires. I think it's heartbreaking because it's just so true. Right? Maybe some of you have found yourself where you stood in a pile of rubble that used to be your life, and you're desperately looking around for anyone to blame. And then there's that moment of stone cold shock when you realize that you have no one to blame but yourself. I've been there. And had it not been for the mercy and grace of Christ, it would have undone me. Yet here I am today, and perhaps I know better than any other woman in this room that the heart is deceitful above all things. I want you to look at how the book of Proverbs says it. Proverbs 4:23 says it this way, "Watch over your heart with due diligence." Does that sound like anything Jesus said in the Garden of Gethsemane? Watch and pray that you do not fall into temptation. So we watch and pray, not just for the enticement of the enemy. James does not even bring that up here. Now, other portions of the Bible will talk about that, but James is not emphasizing that at all, so we're not going to either. So we're not watching for the enticement of the enemy alone, but for the enticement of our own evil desires. So go back to James 1:14. "But each person is tempted when he is lured and enticed by his own desires. Then desire, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is fully grown, brings forth death." So for those of you who love random Bible knowledge, the Greek language is neuter. So that word there for desire, it's gendered. So the Greek language is gendered. That word for desire is a feminine word. So that helps us kind of understand why James put that word picture to it of desire giving birth to sin, and then sin growing and bringing forth death. And I don't know, and that kind of gives me the heebie-jeebies. Anybody else? So here is what we have. On your handout, I have a pictorial representation of what James kind of laid before us. Tia, can you get it up on the big screen? Perfect. Worked. Okay, so we have a trial at top. So we've already talked about that today, how trials and temptations are associated. So a trial hits, and we are going to be hit with a temptation that follows. So is that temptation in and of itself, is that sin or not sin? Not sin. Okay, you don't sound too confident. But being tempted in and of itself is not sinful. So circle that. Circle not sinful. Because who was tempted who was not sinful? Jesus. So being tempted doesn't necessarily indicate sinfulness. Okay? But when we're hit with a temptation, we're going to have to respond. So every temptation requires a response. So we can resist that temptation, and that would be not sinful. Or we can welcome that temptation, and that would be sinful. So we've already talked about what happens when we resist temptation. That was most of what we talked about last week. James was encouraging us, saying that when we meet trials and we press into God, that's going to lead to steadfastness. It's going to lead to perseverance. That's going to lead to a whole and perfect and complete faith. And that is the path to life. And then this week, James is focusing in just a little more on what happens if we welcome that sin. Because that is the point when your desire conceives. And desire conceives, it gives birth to sin. So what is the natural order of things? Like in nature, when a baby is born, what happens to that baby? Does it stay small? No, it grows over time. 9 years ago, I gave birth to this 6-pound baby boy, and he fit in one of my arms. And if he stood on the stage beside me today, you would all be able to testify to the fact that he is well on his way to becoming a full-grown man. So that is the picture that James gives us here of sin. It may start small, but it gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it leads to death. But what I want you to notice here is that at any point along the way, you have the opportunity to bring death to your sin before it brings death to you. But either way, once it is conceived, it is a battle to the death. Number 8 on your handout, we can either put sin to death or it will bring death to us. Listen to the language that Paul uses in Colossians 3:5. He says, "Put to death, therefore, whatever belongs to your earthly nature: sexual immorality, impurity, lust, evil desires, and greed, which is idolatry. Because of these, the wrath of God is coming." Now, I know that in a crowd of women this size, there are those among us who believe that maybe we are the ones who can successfully keep our sin on a leash. Do not deceive yourselves. If you do not put death to your sin, it will bring death to you. Could I get anybody willing to testify to that? So, here's the thing. I know that this picture up here makes everything look nice and understandable, and it's very clear cut, and it's very black and white. I clearly want to go this way. I don't want to go that way. But any of us who have done any living at all knows that life is not always that black and white. And especially when you are in the midst of struggle and hardship and pain, you do not always know which way to go, right? But what have we already learned about our God? That when we have hearts that submit before Him and say, "Father, I love you, I desire to follow you, I want to please you, but this is hard. And I do not know which way to go," He gives wisdom generously. But you have to ask. You have to ask Him for it. I love this verse from Isaiah. It says, "Your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, 'This is the way. Walk in it.'" You know, and I think that when we're desperate enough, like some people think God whispers most of the time. I don't know the theology of any of it, you know? Maybe. I bet He whispers a lot. He seems like a pretty chill dude, okay? But I think that when you are desperate enough, that you cry out, "I do not know which way to go. This way! This is the way to life. Walk in it." I had a conversation just a few days ago with a dear friend of mine, and she is hurting, and she is in pain, and she is at the end of herself. "I don't know, I just don't know. God seems so far away." And I told her, I said, "I don't want to hurt you, I love you, but from where I stand, the choice is so clear. This is the way. Walk in it. Walk in it." Verse 16. "Do not be deceived, my beloved brothers. Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow due to change." So number 9, here, James contrasts the lie that God might tempt His children to evil with the truth that, to the contrary, He gives only good gifts to His children. James contrasts the lie that God might tempt His children to evil with the truth that He only gives good gifts to His children. So this kind of goes back to some of the things that we discussed last week. Faith knows who God is. So whatever our outside circumstances might be, the same God who provided for us when we were in captivity is the same God who redeemed us through the Red Sea. And He is the same God that will provide for us in the wilderness, because He does not change. We waver, but he does not waver toward us. Verse 18. Of his own will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. So James draws his reader's attention to the pinnacle example of the good gifts that the Father gives by leaving us with a picture of our salvation, which Paul describes as a gift of God. James says he brought us forth, so that can also be rendered, he gave us birth, right? A new birth, and he did this by his own will, so that means he chose us, he set his sights on us, and he brought us into him. And then that term, first fruits, a really sweet note to end on. It referred to the first portion of the harvest. So you plant a harvest, you wait, and then the first part of it comes forth. And that is what the Israelites would gather, and they would take those first fruits and they would give it back to God. They would offer it to him. They would consecrate it to him as a sign of their faith that they knew so much more was coming. So the readers of this letter that actually held it in their hands were a kind of first fruits of the great harvest of believers that God was calling to himself. And we stand here in part today because they were faithful in the face of temptation and trial to spread the good news of God's great love. And so now it is our responsibility to stand steadfast in the face of temptation and trial and do the same. So number 10 on your handout, as we encounter temptation, James calls us to a wholehearted commitment to Christ. Okay, I love the ladies so much. Thank you. Karen.